and welcome to Dialect, for the week beginning Sunday the 28th of August. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis. This week, one of Bristol's most influential artists of all time was the painter Relinda Sharples. Her unnerving prophetic painting, The Stoppage of the Banks, is now up in display after lying in the City Art Gallery for several years. Anthea Page reports from the Edinburgh Festival on a new play by a former soldier, and Mike Noyce, our engineer, speaks to a band called Little Rum Club.
Excellent. Malcolm Grieve is also reading another episode of Treasure Island, and we have the weekly What's On Guide from Jeff Sparks.
Dialect is produced by volunteers and is broadcast in Bristol on BCFM 93.2 FM and in St Albans on Radio Verulam. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol just off Queen Square, and the details of that will be at the end of the show.
One of Bristol's most influential artists of all time was a painter, Relinda Sharples, but one of her most unnerving paintings, The Stoppage of the Banks, has been languishing in the vaults of Bristol City Art Gallery for several years now. It's back on display now, and Dialect's Tony Gosling spoke to local historian Julian Lee Jones about who exactly Relinda Sharples was.
I'm Julian Lee Jones. I'm chairman of Temple Oak History Group, and I write books about Bristol and Bristol curiosities. That's based on a lot of the projects and things that we have been researching for the last 25 years about Bristol for the Temple History Group. And we realised we had lots of project files that were just interesting. We'd done the exploration and they were just sat there as project files. So although it was reasonable, the opportunity came from the publishers to put them into book form, and where we've actually tracked down lots of unanswered stories and queries and made connections that we've been able to do by going through our files, and came up with some quite interesting information. You know, people who were supposed to be destitute sailors in Bristol, for example, and all the books said that, and it turned out that they were famous painters, educated people like Benjamin West, and got portraits and paintings in most of the national galleries, both here and in the States. And there were little things like that that we've put into book form.
So we're looking at Relinda Sharples today, who has got quite a special place as a recorder, really, of social history in and around Bristol and other parts of the world, as well as painting some portraits. One of her most relevant and absolutely apposite paintings, really talking about the financial crises of the past, and in a way warning us of the possible collapse of banks and the difficulties that people might have in then actually getting their money out of the banks. So can you tell us, first of all, a bit about Relinda? Who was Relinda Sharples?
Oh, you're referring to her probably one of her most well-known, best-known paintings, the Stoppage of the Banks, so hence the connection with the banking industry and the banking crisis. Relinda, well, actually the whole family, the Sharples family, were very able artists. And Relinda, I mean, we're talking about the end of the 18th century, so what are we talking about, 1790-something, 93, I think it was, she was born.
So how old was she when she first started painting, Relinda?
She was a teenager, a young teenager. The entire family were artists. Her father was American and came over here. And her mother was Ellen. She was James Sharples' third wife. But the whole family were very accomplished artists. But when his third marriage to Ellen, and they were living actually not far from my grandparents, along in St. Vincent's Parade, in Hot Wells. But the mother, Ellen, she was a miniaturist. You've got to remember that they sort of moved back and forth between England and America. And when they were painting in America, and this is where Relinda, although she was born in Bristol, they went back to America. And that's where she learned under her mother's tutelage to draw initially, and she initially worked in pastels, and her mother worked in oils and did port. Her mother had done portraits of pretty well Washington, Jefferson, President Hamilton, Adams. So this was a time in early post-colonial America when getting your portrait painted was a way of showing that you had socially arrived. It was a mark of status. And this is where the story I wrote about in the Bristol Curiosities about William Williams, he did the same thing. He taught Benjamin West to paint. And again, he specialised in doing portraits. Rolinda's mother, Ellen, I mean, apart from painting miniatures of at least four or five presidents in America, when they came here, she'd actually also done portraits of famous people associated with Bristol. Robert Southey, for example, our poet laureate. Humphrey Davy, of course, was the protege of Thomas Beddoes, lived in Rodney Place, and he was best known for the invention of the miner's safety lamp and also laughing gas. Dr. Beddoes was a polymath, involved in lots of things, looking at the ways of curing TB, and he had some rather eccentric ideas. One involved cows, another one involved experiments with frogs and green tea, but that, again, I've written about in the book, and it's just, you couldn't write a story so funny. Then there were people like Herschel, the astronomer, and Priestley, and so the scientific establishment, and remember, this is the time of the beginning of the Royal Society and the Lunar Men. These were the people that she was painting, and those are the portraits, portrait miniatures. Humphrey Davy, Robert Southey, Dr. Beddoes, Herschel, Priestley, so on. She gave these to the fledgling art gallery because her mother actually gave a total of about £5,000 to establish the Royal West of England Academy, the West of England Fine Arts Academy as it was then. She then started painting. Rolinda, this was, also doing portraits. I mean, she was selling work in the sort of family business, if you like, when she was 13, so she was that good. Then when they came back to England, upon her father's death, she started doing general paintings, and she was elected an honorary member of the Society of Artists. And she was one of, if I remember, she was one of the first women who started doing large detail scenes, such as the famous one called The Stopping of the Bank, The Stoppage at the Bank. She painted a lot of detail, their social records, because the balls at the assembly rooms in Clifton and the Mall, and she painted those in detail. And then it was more sort of humdrum things, like the crossing of Rannan Ferry, the people on the ferry, and sort of people having donkey rides down by the Hot Wells on the what is now the Portway. Because, of course, living along in St. Vincent's Parade, she would have seen this as a daily sight, but she actually captured it in amazing detail.
So is it fair to say that in those days, when there was no such thing as photography, obviously, artists like her would graduate, really, from doing bog-standard portraits once they made a success of that and they were really in demand and able to get the best prices for their portrait painting, that they could then branch out into doing what they chose, which was more to do with, you know, recording social history and things like that?
I think the answer is yes, but I take issue with your word bog-standard, because her work was of high quality. The President of the United States wouldn't have somebody doing a bog-standard portrait. But yes, they had the freedom and the reputation to be able to paint, to do in their own genre. There are people who sort of commented, well, of course, they were just pictures, but she has given us valuable social records at a time when photography didn't exist.
So what was the context then of this painting, The Stoppage of the Bank?
Certainly in the Napoleonic Wars, we were, as a country, as now, strapped for cash. I mean, all the money was going to fight the Napoleonic Wars. And you saw this, in, for instance, Savile Place in Clifton. If you look, Savile Place is built in two different distinct styles. Royal York Crescent was built but not completed, and this was due to the problems caused by the Napoleonic Wars. In the 1820s, sort of 1825, about then, we lost about half of the Bristol banks, not because they went bankrupt, they just went out of business. We only had one bank that failed at that time, I believe, and that was Thomas Wiggins Bank, and he was down in Bridge Street, which is down what is now the edge of Castle Park Walk, Riverside Walk. Then what happened after the Napoleonic Wars finished, we recovered, and the financial system then went into overdrive, and I suppose in modern terms you say it overheated, and there was vast amounts of speculation, and there were banks overextended themselves. But again, there was only one bank in Bristol actually failed, many amalgamated, and that was the Bristol Bullion Bank. It was the 20th of December, just before Christmas. It always happens before Christmas. 20th of December in 1825. Relinda was here then. She was flourishing her business. And so that would have been an obvious social scene to paint and record. If you look at her painting, it's based on Corn Street, because, of course, that's where the banks were, Corn Street, Broad Street. If you look at the painting, you see what is recognisably All Saints Tower in the cupola in the distance, and you can see the Dutch house. The scene looks to be stood in front of the Corn Exchange looking towards, I mean, the Dutch house that was destroyed during the last war, you've got to remember, is in that very wide open area that is in front of the, coincidentally, in front of the Bank of England building that is now also gone.
Well, the Bank of England building's still there, isn't it? But it's been, you know, derelict for 15 years or something. One of the other things is just how uncanny it is to see what looks like a sort of gaggle of people forming themselves vaguely into a bit of a queue outside one of the banks. Is very reminiscent of the business that we saw in 2008 with Northern Rock, isn't it?
Yes, there's people looking rather glum, and there's animated conversations, as it would appear to be, from the stance of the people in the scene, but there's nobody running around. There's a child knelt down horse cart with a couple on it, and everybody appears to be in a state of conversational expectancy rather than arm and fist waving. So maybe it was the calm before the storm, I don't know.
In the painting, we've got all sorts of different types of people. You've got, you know, the very wealthy, right down to, you know, what appears to be sort of very basic traders and people like that. A whole selection of different parts of society, one or even waiting on horseback.
Well, doesn't that apply now? Didn't that apply to Northern Rock? Northern Rock wasn't the province. It wasn't the Coutts. It was a bank that was used by everybody, but all strata society, and I think that was true of the bank then, of the Bristol Bullion Bank.
Present day politicians are also trying to make some kind of facility for banks collapsing, saying basically that the government will guarantee people's deposits and this kind of thing. So it does indicate that banking collapse, like the one we see in the picture, Relinda's picture, is not impossible today.
It was a social event. She was recording in the same way that she recorded the races at the Durden Downs and various other items. I think that it was obviously a major happening in Bristol, and again nationally, and Bristol was just reflecting our local concerns and issues. But whether the banks would actually, this would come to pass, and where the government would get the money from to actually guarantee the banks the deposits, safeguard them, I don't know.
Okay, so for anyone who's interested in, you know, getting to know Relinda Sharple's work, whereabouts are good places to actually go and view her paintings today?
You can go along to the Bristol Museum and Art Gallery and ask. If there are prints available of it, I think they're quite expensive. You could also, if you wanted to have a quick look, you could actually just do a web search for the stoppage of the bank. I suggest you put it in quotes, and if you then actually put in Relinda Sharples or just Sharples, you would get from an art gallery's catalogue, probably, because prints are for sale, and you could get an idea of the sort of the detail that she went into, and you'd probably be able to then, if you looked on a search for Relinda Sharples, you would find other examples of her work. But the Bristol Museum City Art Gallery would be a good starting place.
Thank you very much to local historian and author of Bristol Curiosities, Julian Lee Jones, there talking to Dalek's Tony Gosling about arguably Bristol's most prophetic painter in the form of Relinda Sharples. Her painting about the 19th century banking collapse, The Stoppage of the Banks, is now on display at the City Art Gallery, and you can find that at the top of Park Street in Gallery 7. Our regular engineer and power behind the throne, Michael Noyce, has had another band on his sofa. Bristol-based act Little Rum Club popped around for an interview and to record an exclusive live track.
On my sofa today, I've got Josh Shields and Gully Skultoon from Little Rum Club.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Well, let's first of all start with your name. How did you come by that?
Well, basically, we met
over coffee at the canteen and decided to have a jam one night. So we were going to go up to an open mic up the Golden Line, and we decided to go out and buy some drink before.
Just happened to be some rum
because we both love rum. It's our favourite drink. So that was the first kind of thing in common. And after that, we went up to the Golden Line, and when they asked us what we would like to be introduced as, I think the first one we said was the Rummers or something. And then from there, it just kind of developed. And as there's only two of us at the moment, we thought that the Little Rum Club was quite appropriate. So that's it, really.
Oh, that sounds good. So how long have you been playing together?
We've been playing together about 7 months now. So we're still pretty new to the Bristol scene. But I mean, 7 months done quite well, haven't we? We've been working quite hard, getting a lot of gigs all about Bristol. Some quite high-profile gigs. Not massively high-profile, but high-profile for us anyway, considering we weren't doing anything 7 months ago. Yeah, so we've been working quite hard, and I think, yeah, we've achieved quite a lot in a short space of time, I think.
So how have you done that? Have you sort of got your own promotion company? Or you?
No, we do it all ourselves, believe it or not.
There's been all sorts of things. I mean, we've been very dedicated to following the open mic network because it's so well established in Bristol. So we've been playing, if not more than once every single week, pretty much since we started together. And through that, just making contacts, talking to people. We've been out busking a few times. We managed to get
some really good recording
sort of like free recording sorted out through busking on the street. Yeah, that's basically it, really, just talking to people and
just getting out and getting involved. I think that's the main thing.
Yeah,
I mean, if anyone's looking for any advice, I think the best thing is just to get out and get yourself involved, and you can send your music to as many people as you can.
Then obviously, once we had the recording done, we set up our Facebook page and links to SoundCloud, and then just wrote to as many venues as we could find and just keep constantly writing to them. Like, you don't often hear back for a while, but then if you're quite persistent, then you do get a good outcome. So yeah.
Okay, so your music's on both SoundCloud and
Facebook.
Yeah, so you just have to look for
Little Rum Club. Yeah.
So what style of music would you call it?
Well, it's always changing for us, really. We don't categorise ourselves in a specific genre, but we're really sort of inspired by sort of soul, blues. You're quite a folky sound, actually, when it comes together.
Yeah, mostly soul. I mean, I'd say I personally have been very influenced by some of the old jazz legends like Billie Holiday and Etta James on the sort of blues front. So
it's really lucky because I'm just into cheesy pop, so.
Such as?
Aqua, can you remember
that?
Fast Food Rockers, quite recent.
Yeah, no. We don't really bring elements of that in.
I know, we're joking.
So who are you influenced by then, Josh?
Well, I could reel off a list of guitarists, you know, it could be anything to anyone, all the greatest guitarists of all time. You know, I could literally sit here and reel them off, you know, Slash, Jimi Hendrix, all the way through to sort of more acoustic guitarists. Recently, I saw Jack Johnson. Well, all kinds of influences. I could sit here all day and talk to you about all my influences, but yeah, take a long time, I think.
So have you got anything else coming up? Any more gigs?
We've got quite a few gigs in the next few weeks. We're playing at the Big Chill on the 25th of August, Big Chill Bar in Bristol. Playing at the Pork and Cider Festival on the 27th of this month. I'm not exactly sure where that is. We've got a couple of other ones in September, but the biggest thing for us at the moment is our first tour, which dates are not quite confirmed yet, but sort of the second week of October in Italy.
Italy? Well, how did that come about?
Well, basically, I'm a bit of a fan of Gumtree. I don't know, I'm sure people are aware of Gumtree, but I like looking for strange adverts and replying to them, see what can come of them. And Fenix One looking for musicians to go to Italy, basically. The Italian promoter's looking for English bands. I think he's still probably looking for them, actually. but yeah, replied to him, had a bit of communication.
And we basically just sent him links to our music and videos, and
he liked
what he saw. And he's setting up 5 dates for us in 7 days, including a festival somewhere. We're not entirely sure of this location.
It's a bit of a magical mystery tour.
We're meeting him next week and we're going to finalise everything, but it's very exciting.
Well, that all sounds brilliant. So, you gather you're going to play a song for us now?
We are.
And what's it called?
It's called A Matter of Time.
So this is Little Rum Club with A Matter of Time.
River flow to the ocean, I will follow right behind. Watch you grow As the waves crash in, they will tell you where to go. For the sea is your master, you will say, in his arms like a child coming home to his mother time after time. Oh, time, 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 it's just a matter of time before it all runs out, before you see that all the time you wasted, all the time you gained, take all the time you need, but it still stays the same. So breathe with the seasons and stay in the game. Time is just a metaphor to ease the pain, but flow like a river and the time will come when you join the sea and you flow as a one, yeah. Butterfly in the twilight, I will follow right behind. What a life. As the sun goes down, you must find your place in the night. For the flowers are seeping, will you see them again? Like an ocean without a river, will one day come to an end? One time, 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 it's just a matter of time before it all runs out, before you see that all the time you wasted, all the time you gained, take all the time you need, but it still stays the same. So breathe with the seasons and stay in the game. Time is just a metaphor to ease the pain, but flow like a river and the time will come when you join the sea. Sunlight, I will follow right behind. As you fly on the summer wind, how I envy you this life. For the air is your master, and you master it with ease, like a feather floating down towards the sea on a summer breeze.
So that was a Little Rum Club with A Matter of Time. If you want to contact Little Rum Club, you can email them at littlerumclub@yahoo.com, and you can go to their Facebook page or their SoundCloud, which is soundcloud.com or facebook.com, and just search for Little Rum Club. So Little Rum Club, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, huh?
That was Bristol band Little Rum Club.
Bristol's historic Filton Airfield is set to close soon to make way for housing. So Dialect has been looking back at Bristol and Somerset's role in aviation history. This week, more from our aircraft museum, the Bristol Aero Collection, based at Kemble Airfield in Gloucestershire. Dialect's Tony Gosling spoke to the collection's chairman, Oliver Dearden, about the diversification of the Bristol Aeroplane Company after World War II, when it had grown to be the biggest aircraft manufacturer in the world.
In 1949... after the war, the company learnt its lesson after the First World War, that suddenly the level of production drops because suddenly the war's come to an end. So they had to diversify. Now, they did two things. They went into guided weapons and helicopters and cars. They formed Bristol Cars, which is still going today, out at Patchway, although not owned by the company. They were separate, they went off on their own in about 1960. And Bristol started a guided weapon. Well, they also started a plastics division, as you now call it, composite materials, but stood there looking at you, believe it or not, as a product of the Bristol Aeroplane Company.
That was quite a sensible. It was a sensible idea, wasn't it? At the end of the war, if you've got all that factory and all that expertise,
you diversify. Yes. So they went that. They built sailing dinghies. They built motor torpedo boats, and it developed into the great composite materials that industry you've got today. I mean, that is the development of what's there. They went into guiding weapons, and this huge thing at the end here, which looks like something from space.
Well, it is. Okay, this looks like a gigantic kind of missile thing here. I wouldn't like to be standing near this when it goes off.
That missile is a Bristol Bloodhound, designed by Bristol's and Ferrante's. The electronics are probably Ferrante's. And that was developed from 1949, and it went into service with the RAF in 1957, I think. And that was our defence in the Cold War until 1991. And that was a ground-to-air missile. It had a range of about 80 miles. It was powered. It was launched by four solid-fuel booster rockets. By the time it went through the roof of this building, it was going supersonic.
Right, so it didn't hang around.
It didn't hang around. And it was never used in anger, but was very, very accurate on trials. And that was one of the first products of the Bristol Guided Weapons Company. There it is being launched, and it will tell you. Yeah, by the time the missile... You see, this missile is just... The back end is just leaving its launcher. It's doing about 400 miles an hour. By the time it reaches 25 feet, which is the height of this hangar, it's doing about 720. And it goes on at 2.5 times the speed of sound.
That is pretty quick, isn't
it? Yeah, and look at the size of it. Today, that'd be a little thing about this size. Yeah, but that was the electronics of the day. They also went into helicopters. Over here, not many people realise that Bristol built helicopters. And here they are. The one on the left, here, is a Bristol Sycamore, named after a sycamore leaf seed, and it drops. It's a bit like a helicopter. They set up a helicopter division in 1945. That helicopter flew in 1947, sold to the RAF, the German Air Force. It was the first British-built helicopter to get a certificate of airworthiness. And then, from that, they developed this chap here. Now, this
is quite a slick-looking machine, actually. It's quite nice lines.
This is the Bristol 173.
Now, it's got twin rotor blades, one on the front and one on the back.
It's got two engines. It's got one at the front, one at the back. And it's got two rotors. Well, it doesn't, not like the single-rotor helicopters have to have a tail rotor to stabilise them. This had a big lifting rotor at each end, and this was probably the world's first twin-engined tandem rotor helicopter. It flew in 1952. It had a lot of teething troubles, obviously, but it was successful. And a later version, the Belvedere, went into the service of the RAF.
Now,
forerunner of the Chinook.
It's actually quite a sort of long metal tube with a stalk at the back end. It's also got, the one of the things I really like about this is it's got this lovely glass bubble where the pilot's feet are.
That's right, he can see the ground when he's going into land. They're always like that, yeah.
And, it's actually quite nice lines. It's a very sort of 1950s, 60s design.
Considering it was designed in 1950, and it was called a rotor coach because it could have carried passengers.
But it never did?
No, it never went into service. They built five prototypes of this one. Only two flew. One actually crashed at Filton. Well, it had a mishap at Filton during an air display. But its successor was this chap, the Bristol Belvedere, and that did go into service with the RAF. And the Belvedere has one famous use. There it is. There is Coventry Cathedral, and they had to put a big metal structure on top. It was put on by, but there it is, suspended from a Belvedere. The Belvedere delivered it and positioned it because it could hover.
One of the things that's quite disappointing about this is quite a lot of the stuff that seems to have been designed as prototypes at Bristol, is it was it was developed, but it wasn't ever actually hardly used at all.
Well, this, it was, because that it became that. And that was in service with the RAF in Malaya and Aden.
So you're saying that maybe that much of what the aviation designers are doing is actually developing prototypes just to see how they work and then maybe redesigning them.
Well, yeah, but that went on. But then when all the aircraft industry was amalgamated, the Bristol Aeroplane Company disappeared into the British Aircraft Corporation with Vickers and English Electric. And then after that, all the aircraft companies were merged into what would they call themselves next? British Aerospace.
So when did that happen then? When did the Bristol Aircraft Company get nationalised?
Well, it wasn't nationalised. It wasn't. They were forced to amalgamate by the government. And that started in about 1959, right through the 1960s to early 1970.
Why was that then?
Because there wasn't enough work to keep all these different companies going. So it was better to concentrate all their efforts on a national company rather than on lots of individual ones. But what's happened now, there are very few aircraft manufacturing plants left. The biggest in the country is in Bristol, because you've got Rolls-Royce and you've got Airbus.
So other than Bristol, who else is making aircraft in Britain?
English Electric, or BAE Systems as they are now, at Wharton near Preston. Blackburn's, or BAE Systems as they are at Brough, making the Hawk. That's it. People like de Havilland's, Vickers factories have all gone.
That was Dialect's Tony Gosling there, talking to chairman of the Bristol Aero Collection, Oliver Dearden. Next week, the last aircraft ever to roll off the Bristol production line, Concorde.
Carl O'Neill was inspired to write a play about two British soldiers. The play Think Wello Singer was broadcast on Irish National Radio. In this interview, Carl talks about how war affects everyone caught up in it. The intro music is War Elegy, composed by Ivor Gurney.
Carl O'Neill from Dublin.
Why are you here at the Gurney Society event today in Churchdown, Gloucestershire?
Well, I've been a member of the Society for about 15, 16 years. I came across Ivor Gurney in the early 80s, loved his poems and his music, found out that we shared a birthday, which helped, and I've written...
What's your birthday?
28th of August. I've written a few things about Gurney, including radio play, which was broadcast last Easter Sunday, starring Ciarán Hinds and Brenda Blethyn. It's called Think Well, O Singer, and RTÉ, which is Ireland's national broadcaster, broadcast the play, and it's set in Twigworth at Ivor Gurney's graveside. And it relates to an Irish man from South Armagh, which is where I come from originally, in Northern Ireland, and an English woman who has just opened up the church in Twigworth for the Sunday service, and they meet and talk, and something from the man's past comes out, which has a strong link with another church in Gloucester, the Mary de Lode, and a particular happening on Saturday, the 14th of May, 1977, in a pub in South Armagh, involving a military figure from Gloucester. Now, intriguing.
Go on, tell us.
Well, in St. Mary de Lode Church behind Gloucester Cathedral, there's a window dedicated to Ivor Gurney. Beside it, there's a window dedicated to Captain Robert Nyrack, who, on the Saturday the 14th of May 1977, went undercover, possibly on his own behalf, into a pub, a Republican pub in South Armagh, pretending to be an IRA man from Belfast. He got up and he sang a couple of Republican songs. Of course, the locals knew he wasn't.
Go on, tell us more about the plot.
Okay. Well, as I said, I'm originally from Armagh in Northern Ireland. A few years ago, I visited Gloucester and went to see this Gurney window in St. Mary de Lode, the church behind Gloucester Cathedral. And right beside it, there was another window dedicated to another English army officer, Captain Robert Nairac. Now, from where I come from, Robert Nairac was a notorious figure. He walked into a pub in South Armagh in his civvies on Saturday, the 14th of May, 1977, pretending to be an IRA man. He got up and sang a couple of Republican ballads. The local people, of course, knew he wasn't who he said he was. And late that night, out in the car park, he was jumped on. He was dragged into a car, driven across the border, which is only 2 or 3 miles away, interrogated. A local IRA man shot him. He was killed, buried. Subsequently, animals disturbed the burial spot, and he was moved away, and his body has never been discovered. He remains one of the disappeared. Now, Nairac had strong connections with loyalist paramilitaries, some of whom were engaged in notorious acts like the Dublin and Monaghan bombings, and we don't know exactly what he was up to, whether he was acting on his own behalf, whether he was there officially undercover. But seeing those two windows side by side, Robert Nairac and Ivor Gurney, I thought, there's a story here somewhere. So I wrote this play, which involves a character who was a young man in the pub that night in Drumontee in South Armagh and had an opportunity of warning this man. He didn't know who he was and didn't. And then subsequently, he'll come across the body. So,
so is it a play about guilt then?
It's a play about, yes, it's a play also about the desecration of graves, because around 10 years ago, Ivor Gurney's gravestone was broken, and a number of war graves in Treadworth Cemetery in Gloucester were also damaged. Don't know why, but they were. And so it's about soldiers, war, poetry. There's a big mix there. It's about a man whose own life tangentially was affected by this, coming across this body. He is actually warned by the IRA that he has to get out. So he goes across to America. He ends up then coming back and living in a place called Slane, north-west of Dublin, where Francis Ledwidge, First World War poet, comes from. And that's why he got into First World War poet. It's about how we regard soldiers and poets. It's about people on the edge of conflict and how they get drawn into it.
Innocent people.
They're innocent people. But everybody has a connection with any conflict, and particularly the conflict in the north. My family had no involvement in the Troubles, but because of the Troubles, we left Northern Ireland and went to the south of Ireland in the middle of the 1970s. It's about the ripple effect of a conflict. My family, I grew up in the centre of Armagh, where there was a lot of explosions, a lot of shootings going on around us, and my parents decided enough was enough, and they could just about afford to leave 1976, and we left and went south of the border to a quieter spot. So our family was disrupted because of the Troubles, even though we had no involvement in anything. So it's just about that, people on the edge of conflict, and also about how we regard soldiers and war. But I'm not sure about commemorating war, soldiers, conflict, and the dirty job that soldiers are required to do on behalf of governments. For me, growing up in Northern Ireland as from the nationalist background, even though we would never have been supporters of the IRA or Sinn Féin, to have an interest in an English soldier, albeit a war poet, is a strange one, and you're almost labelled as a kind of West Brit, is the phrase often used. But I don't blame soldiers for the acts that they're doing on behalf of governments. It's like the invasion of Iraq. totally illegal, totally wrong. But you don't blame the soldiers on the ground, you know? So anyway, there's a whole mix of things in there, but it's mainly, there's two middle-aged people meeting and being attracted to each other. They happen to come from different parts of the world, and there happens to be a couple of connections.
So what's the name of the play?
The play is Think Well, O Singer, which comes from a poem by Ivor Gurney. The songs I had are withered or vanished clean, yet there are bright tracks where I have been, and there grow flowers for others' delight. Think well, O singer, soon comes night. Robert Nyrack was singing in the pub that night. And then what happened?
Thank you very much to Carl O'Neill. He was talking to Anthea Page there about his play Think Well, O Singer.
Next up, we've got this week's episode of Treasure Island, which is chapter 17, and it's been read by Malcolm Grieve.
Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 4, The Stockade. Chapter 17, narrative continued by the Doctor. The Jolly Boat's Last Trip. This fifth trip was quite different from any of the others. In the first place, the little galley pot of a boat that we were in was gravely overloaded. Five grown men, and three of them, Trelawney, Red Ruth and the captain, over 6 feet high, was already more than she was meant to carry. Add to that the powder, pork and bread bags. The gunwale was lipping astern. Several times we shipped a little water, and my breeches and the tails of my coat were all soaking wet before he had gone 100 yards. The captain made us trim the boat, and we got her to lie a little more evenly. All the same, we were afraid to breathe. In the second place, the ebb was now making. A strong rippling current running westward through the basin and then southward and seaward down the straits by which we had entered in the morning. Even the ripples were a danger to our overloaded craft. But the worst of it was that we were swept out of our true course and away from our proper landing place behind the point. If we let the current have its way, we should come ashore beside the gigs, where the pirates might appear at any moment. "I cannot keep her head for the stockade, sir," said I to the captain. I was steering while he and Red Ruth, two fresh men, were at the oars. "The tide keeps washing her down. Could you pull a little stronger?" "Not without swamping the boat," said he. "You must bear up, sir, if you please. Bear up until you see you're gaining." I tried, and found by experiment that the tide kept sweeping us westward until I had laid her head due east, or just about right angles to the way we ought to go. "We'll never get ashore at this rate," said I. "If it's the only course that we can lie, sir, we must even lie it," returned the captain. "We must keep upstream. You see, sir," he went on, "if once we drop to leeward of the landing place, it's hard to say where we should get ashore, besides the chance of being boarded by the gigs. Whereas the way we go, the current must slacken, and then we can dodge back along the shore." "The current's less already, sir," said the man grey who was sitting in the foresheets. "You can ease her off a bit." "Thank you, my man," said I, quite as if nothing had happened, for we had all quietly made up our minds to treat him like one of ourselves. Suddenly the captain spoke up again, and I thought his voice was a little changed. "The gun," said he. "I have thought of that," said I, for I made sure he was thinking of a bombardment of the fort. "They could never get the gun ashore, and if they did, they could never haul it through the woods. Look astarn, doctor. replied the captain. We had entirely forgotten the Long Nine. And there, to our horror, were the five rogues busy about her, getting off her jacket, as they called the stout tarpaulin cover under which she sailed. Not only that, but it flashed into my mind at the same moment that the round shot and the powder for the gun had been left behind, and a stroke with an axe would put it all into the possession of the evil ones aboard. "Israel, was Flint's gunner?" said Grey hoarsely. At any risk, we put the boat's head direct for the landing place. By this time we had got so far out of the run of the current that we kept steerage way, even at our necessarily gentle rate of rowing, and I could keep her steady for the goal. But the worst of it was that with the course I now held, we turned our broadside instead of our stern to the Hispaniola, and offered a target like a barn door. I could hear as well as see that brandy-faced rascal Israel Hands plumping down a round shot on the deck. "Who's the best shot?" asked the captain. "Mr. Trelawney, out and away," said I. "Mr. Trelawney, will you please pick me off one of these men, sir?" "Hands, if possible," said the captain. Trelawney was as cool as steel. He looked to the priming of his gun. "Now," cried the captain, "easy with that gun, sir, or you'll swamp the boat. All hands stand by to trim her when he aims." The squire raised his gun, the rowing ceased, and we leaned over to the other side to keep the balance. And all was so nicely contrived that we did not ship a drop. They had the gun by this time slewed round upon the swivel, and Hans, who was at the muzzle, was by consequence the most exposed. However, we had no luck, for just as Trelawney fired, down he stooped, and the ball whistled over him, and it was one of the other four who fell. The cry he gave was echoed not only by his companions on board, but by a great number of voices from the shore, and looking in that direction, I saw the other pirates trooping out from among the trees and tumbling into their places in the boats. "Here come the gigs, sir," said I. "Give way, then," cried the captain. "We mustn't mind if we swamp her now. If we can't get ashore, all's up." "Only one of the gigs is being manned, sir," I added. "The crew of the other most likely going round by shore to cut us off."
"They'll have a hot run, sir," returned the captain. "Jack ashore, you know. It's not them I mind, it's the round shot. Carpet bowls! My lady's maid couldn't miss. Tell us, squire, when you see the match, and we'll hold water."
In the meanwhile, we had been making headway at a good pace for a boat so overloaded, and we had shipped but little water in the process. We were now close in, 30 or 40 strokes, and we should beach her, for the ebb had already disclosed a narrow belt of sand below the clustering trees. The gig was no longer to be feared. The little point had already concealed it from our eyes. The ebb tide, which had so cruelly delayed us, was now making reparation and delaying our assailants. The one source of danger was the gun. "If I durst," said the captain, "I'd stop and pick off another man." But it was plain that they meant nothing should delay their shot. They had never so much as looked at their fallen comrade, though he was not dead, and I could see him trying to crawl away.
"Ready!"
cried the squire.
"Hold!"
cried the captain, quick as an echo, and he and Redruth backed with a great heave that sent her stern bodily under water. The report fell in at the same instant of time. This was the first that Jim heard, the sound of the squire's shot not having reached him. Where the ball passed, not one of us precisely knew, but I fancy it must have been over our heads, and that the wind of it may have contributed to our disaster. At any rate, the boat sank by the stern quite gently, in 3 feet of water, leaving the captain and myself facing each other on our feet. The other three took complete headers, and came up again drenched and bubbling. So far there was no great harm. No lives were lost, and we could wade ashore in safety. But there were all our stores at the bottom. And to make things worse, only 2 guns out of 5 remained in a state for service. Mine I had snatched from my knees and held over my head by a sort of instinct. As for the captain, he had carried his over his shoulder by a bandolier, and like a wise man, lock uppermost. The other 3 had gone down with the boat. To add to our concern, we heard voices already drawing near us in the woods along the shore, and we had not only the danger of being cut off from the stockade in our half-crippled state, but the fear before us, whether if Hunter and Joyce were attacked by half a dozen,
they would have the sense and conduct to stand firm. Hunter was steady, that we knew. Joyce was a doubtful case. A pleasant, polite man for a valet, and to brush one's clothes, but not entirely fitted for a man of war. With all this in our minds, we waded ashore as fast as we could, leaving behind us the poor jolly boat and a good half of all our powder and provisions.
That was Chapter 17 of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson, read for us by Malcolm Grieve.
It's time to welcome Jeff Sparks for this week's What's On Guide.
Thank you. Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 2nd of September, New Revolution Music Promotions presents Mongols of Rock, the New Breed, at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Muse, Bristol. On the night, expect performances from A Plague of Deception, Consecration, Malicious Intent, Immersed Earth, and also Scarf. Doors open at 7 p.m. and entry is £7.50 on the door or £6.50 with a flyer, and it's all in support of Dogs Friends charity. Into Saturday, 3rd of September, DJ Derek will be performing along with DJ Beavis at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets cost £4 in advance and £5 on the door. On to Song of the Week, and I present Captain Beefheart and his Magic Band. This group were active from 1965 until 1992, and in that time released 12 albums. This is from the album Trout Mask Replica, which was released in 1969, and is the song Ella Guru.
Now here she come walking, looking like a zoo.
Hello, hello,
hi Ella, hi Ella Guru. She know all the colors that nature do.
Ella Guru, Ella Guru.
Hi Ella, hi Ella Guru. Hi yellow, hi red, hi blue she blew. Hi yellow, hi Ella Guru. She do what she mean and she do what she do. Got something for me, got something for you. She show something.
Mascara stay fast and bulbous, tight also.
That was Captain Beefheart and his Magic Band with Ella Guru from the album Trout Mask Replica. For more information, you can check out www.beefheart.com. Keeping with Saturday, 3rd of September, Turbo Wolf will be performing with support from Dinosaur Pileup, Scarlet Rascal and the Trainwreck, Goranga and also Cutosis at the Croft in Stokes Croft, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets cost £4 in advance. Finally, on Sunday, 4th of September, James Morton and friends will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Sunday afternoon at 2. It's also broadcast on Radio Verulam in St Albans. If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every week when the Dialect podcast goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk.
Reporters this week were Tony Gosling and Anthea Page, and also Michael Noyce. Studio production was by the aforementioned Mike Noyce, and the producer was Tony Gosling.
Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. So if you'd like to do that, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web as well at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. Goodbye.
Fascinating.